Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, five-star reviewing, all those wonderful things that you guys do to get the word out about the podcast and the National Coast Guard Museum. We really thank you for all of your support.
Yeah, everybody, thank you. If it's your first time being here, we're glad you found us. After you like what you hear, because we know you're going to, because we love what we do and we love what we hear every time. Go back, subscribe, follow us on any social media platform, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. Go to your browser, type in They Had to Go Out, and you'll find us. Email us, reach out if you've got a good story or you know somebody who has a good story. And remember to hit the like button and give us those five-star reviews, please.
Dude, and so now we're going to give you a reason, as I've said before, a reason to do all that stuff.
We almost had the flow perfect.
We did. Hey, we've got a really cool one today. So we told you guys that that May was going to be the month of the Chief Petty Officer. We've got a retired MK machinery technician senior chief with us today. And she is also the owner of Halcyon Reflections, which is doing the centennial, what would you call it, Tina, the centennial booklet for the chiefs?
Yeah, it's kind of like a logbook, a chief's history logbook for not only kind of reflecting on the chief's history, but also individuals' history as they served as chiefs.
Cool. It's going to be awesome because there's not, we were talking to Vince Patton the other day, there's not a whole lot of chief history captured. And yeah. I think this is a great opportunity to do it. And I'm stoked to see the final product. And luckily, we kind of reached out to her. She had said that with the centennial celebration, the in-person drinking fest kind of canceled for this year. we're just trying to raise visibility on this thing, get it out there as a memento for everybody that wants to celebrate 100 years of the chief. And, luckily, she happens to be a retired senior chief machinery technician, so we wanted to get her on.
That wasn't a drinking fest. That was a chance to build partnerships and network facilitate our working relationships.
That's what it was for all the active duty guys. For all the veterans that we interview, it was a drinking fest. And we know this is the case. Yeah, I wasn't going on the active duty side, Bill. I was going with the vets. Right. Yeah,
I got you. I got you.
But once a chief, always a chief. So, yes. I'm glad you corrected me, man. Hey, so who we've got today, Mrs. Tina Claflin, born and raised in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1994 with Recruit Company Hotel 145. First assignment was on the tall ship Eagle. I cannot wait to hear about that at some point. Went from there to MKA school, so at least they steered her to a very correct operational rating and not something crazy.
A real rate,
one that does things. Despite the Eagle, I can't imagine having that much machinery, but whatever. went from A school to Station Barnegat Light out in New Jersey. I think a surf station, at least heavy weather. From there to another unique assignment, the Atlantic Strike Team out of Fort Dix, New Jersey. Can't wait to hear about that. And then somehow made the decision to go back to the Eagles. She says it's a funny story. I can't wait to hear that. Went from there to further her education with a listed education opportunity titled the Advanced Computer Engineering and Technology Program. So pretty cool way the service to give back and pay it forward. Went from there to Sector Long Island Sound. Made chief, and as many boot chiefs, got the boot to the Coast Guard Cutter Midget. And then from the midget went to headquarters as the Woman Afloat Coordinator, so she could speak to a ton of issues, I'm sure, with that program and how it's furthering that campaign. And then worked for the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, Military Campaign Office at headquarters. Retired in 2016 after 22 years of faithful service. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Stoked for it.
We're glad to have you, Tina. And given that career, I can't wait to ask this question. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, it probably wasn't on Eagle, but you know, I had to think about this a little bit. I would say without a doubt, most of the daring rescues or sea stories that I have came from Barnegat Light, New Jersey. At the
duh.
Small
duh. I knew that was going to be the case. Like the small boat station had to be
like,
it.
I think the Eagle is like band camp for
Right. Yeah. But Barnegat Light was, I mean, this is before they had, you know, classified surfmen or whatever, but it was a surf station. It was one of the most dangerous inlets on the East Coast. I was at MK3, fresh out of MK school, you know, engineer on board 44s and 41s at the time. The inlet was insane. I mean, to go play in the surf, that was awesome. We loved doing that. We had, you know, we kind of had our set crew, our boat crews that we worked with on a daily basis and we stood duty with. So we all kind of knew each other and we had that kind of mesh and that bond. And there was one particular case that I recall that we had to go about 20, 25 miles south into Atlantic City to pull a 40-foot sailboat out of the surf because they were getting ready to go aground. The crew members were seasick and all that stuff. And it started with about 8-foot seas. And by the time, you know, we left about 8 o'clock in the morning, and by the time we got back to Barnegat Light Inlet, it was about 3:00, 1500 in the afternoon. So it was a pretty long haul back into our AOR. And by the time we got back, we were facing like 14-foot seas.
Yes, that's a way to come home. That's a homecoming right there.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's nothing more awesome than being on a 44 in those kind of seas. Like, you know, at the time you're kind of like freaking out, but you trust your crew and you trust the coxswain. Eric Dahlberg was an amazing coxswain. You know, Rob Goley, they're all really good friends of mine still. And we just had this like, you know, mesh crew that got it done. And I remember, and I was trying to think if this was the same case, and I'm just going to say it is because it sounds really cool, but
we're not going to reference. So
Eric would take that 44 and he backed in, you know, went stern to into the inlet because the waves in the inlet was so crappy that, you know, we had to like take the seas off the stern. And you know, that sailboat that we were towing behind had to get in without us capsizing it. And he, you know, we're pointing out like waves, yelling off waves, and he's watching the sailboat and we're watching going into the inlet. And, you know, we got it in, we all survived. And, you know, Eric can probably tell you a much greater story. He's a good sea storyteller, so you should have him on the show.
Talk to us about being the engineer. So I know, you know, from what I remember on the 47s, the making rounds. What's it like to make rounds on a 44?
I mean, basically, you know, you just go down there and you kind of like brace yourself, open the hatch, and you kind of go in. You need to do like a hold on, try not to burn yourself on the Detroits, and go in, check, make sure nothing's like blowing up, and get out and back up on deck. So.
Flooding at that point, right? That's all you're really looking for.
Yeah, exactly.
The fumes, dude. Yeah, I could drive a boat all day, but man, the minute you put me in the engine room with the fumes, it's just it's brutal. I don't know how you guys do it.
I don't know. I'd get seasick every once in a while, but I'd go down in the engine room, I'd be fine. I'd be like, okay, this is home.
You're good. It's warm and it's not wet.
Yeah.
It's an MK thing, Phil. They thrive on it.
I don't know it's how, like man.
They need the smell of diesel to live.
So brutal. Well, so when you guys are towing back in, talk to us about the inlet right there. So, I mean, you said is it breaking the whole time? Is it?
It's breaking. Yeah. It's like a big washing machine. I mean, they're crashing all different directions. You don't have like a set coming in that's consistent. And you're just all over the place. And that bar would change so much because of the, you know, the sand washing in and out. And it just would change a lot. So the coxswains really had to, they had to read the waves and read that bar and know it like, you know, no tomorrow. So
you hear all that, you West Coast surfmen, it's confused on the East Coast. It's not, not 18 second periods between swells and stuff. Yeah, that's good.
Right. And 8 feet on the East Coast is not 8 feet on the West Coast. That's a very different world.
Yeah. That's 8 feet of like brutal backbreaking chaos. Yeah.
That half a second later, here comes the next one.
Right. So when you guys are towing the sailboat back in, it's breaking, right, at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what, like, where are you at? Where are you positioned? Because that, I mean, that's huge. I haven't towed in the surf before. I get it. Like, that is, that's.
So, you know, because we'd have, I think we had Erica Coxon, it was myself, Rob Goley, and I think we had one other non-rate crew member on board. So, you know, we're watching the inlet. You know, the waves coming across the bar, he's watching the sailboat towing, and, you know, we're kind of positioned in all areas where we can all see kind of 360 around the boat and around the inlet and kind of like getting us into there. So once you get into the inlet, it's almost like, okay, we're there and it's calm and, you know, and then you're just trucking in. Cause we were right next to the inlet, at Barnegat Light there. So.
And that's when it always seems to go wrong. Did it go wrong when you guys got them in into the?
No, no. We got them in. Got them moored up at a little fishing marina right there. We, you know, got them out of the boat, and they were sick and just miserable. I think that boat was from the West Coast, so if I remember right. But yeah,
very cool.
Yeah.
What talk to us how so the Eagle. We got to get to the Eagle. How does a non-rate tour on the cadet training tall ship go?
It's a really good question. So the funny thing is when I went to boot camp, the recruiter offered me like guaranteed district, right? And I was like, no, I'm not taking it. I'm just going to see where the chips fall I want to come in and do whatever, you know. When you fill out those little dream sheets that they give you, where do you guys want to go? I remember I put any cutter.
Nobody reads them.
So I knew I wanted to go to a cutter, and I wanted to do something new and different and get out of Wisconsin, you know. So I put any cutter, any district. I wanted to be an MK. I knew I wanted to be an MK, so I was hoping for a fireman billet. And when they're dishing out orders, they're like, oh, Claflin, you're going to the Eagle. And everybody's like, oh, my God, that's amazing. And I'm like, what is the Eagle? I don't even know what it is. So one of my friends, she told me, she's like, oh, you're so lucky. She was going to the Midget. I'm like, I would have rather gone to the Midget at the time. And I open up my helmsman or my Blue Jackets manual, and they're like, here's the Eagle. And I'm like, it's a sailboat. Like, I want to be an MK. Like, you're sending me to a sailboat for real? So, you know, I was like, all right, well, that's cool. And then I went home, you know, on leave. I told my uncle, he was used to be in the Coast Guard, and he's like, oh, you got the best billet, blah, blah, blah. You're going to have so much fun. You're going to learn so much. I was like, all right, cool. Drove there when I was reporting. Again, you know, I'm fresh out of Wisconsin. I'm young, naive, dumb. Drove there, got to New London, and I don't know, have you guys been to New London? Yep. I mean, it used to be a pretty bad area. It still kind of is. But
it was not nice in the early
2000s. So, like, I'm 19 and I'm driving in at like midnight, and I have like 2 days before I report. So, I had to stop and get gas and stop at a hotel. And there's cops, like, you know, running around the hotel building just checking on things. And I'm like, this is interesting. I thought the Eagle was going to be at the Academy. And so the next day I drive to the Academy and there's no Eagle. I'm like, I don't even know where this boat is. Like, so I stop into the work life office and ask for help. Like, how do I get to this boat? And I'm reporting, I'm nervous, I'm scared. So one of the young lieutenants there at worked at the work life building. She brought me the next day to report and get on board, salute the wrong end of the boat. And the non-rates are all there staring me down. And I'm like,
just judging hard. Right?
Judging hard.
That's what they do.
And they're all rough looking. They're full of paint, all Beckys, you know, and
Right. Like,
this is, you know, weird.
So did you get a fireman billet?
I did, actually. Okay. I did get a fireman billet. So, and it actually turned out pretty cool because, you know, I didn't have a lot of like engineering knowledge. So to learn engineering on, you know, a sailboat, but it had all the basic equipment that I would have needed to learn at that level of my career. So, Right. And because it was a training ship, the focus was on training and, you know, you follow along with the cadet training programs to learn all these systems. And I learned so much on that boat, probably, you know, more than I would ever have in any other unit in the Coast Guard. So I was really fortunate to actually get Eagle. And the crew, you know, we were a small crew and, you know, we had cadets all summer long and then we had officer candidates, you know, spring and fall, you know, it was just go, 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 go. But when you're just the crew on board the ship, it was a great billet. You know, we had a lot of really good people on that boat. So
how big is the crew on Eagle, the permanent crew?
So I think in 94, it was like less than 50. And I think it wavers around 50, 60, maybe more now. I think they have
that's a good size crew.
Yeah.
That's like the perfect size, really, because you know everybody.
Yep.
It's big enough to get away from people you don't feel like seeing for a day.
Yeah, exactly.
Bill, that's your MO too, man. Like, it's got to be big enough so I can get away from people that I don't like.
I love that's it. That's why I loved my tour on the 210.
I know.
Because, like, I knew everybody on board. It wasn't a huge crew. But if I didn't really want to see you, I could avoid you for a day or two.
Yeah. Yep.
Hey, Tina, do you ever watch Below Deck Sailing Yacht or whatever it's called, something like that? Have you seen it?
I don't think so.
No. Well, they run like a yacht. Anyway, they're on a sailboat. I don't know anything about sailboats, especially like tall ships. But every time, it's like they're motoring around, you know, on their engine with the sails down. And then the sails go up and everybody's like, we're sailing. And then they get this like this. I can't describe it like a euphoria stare kind of thing. Is the same thing happen on Eagle? Is it like, we're sailing, and then everybody's happy.
It is, huh? Down and just sail, and it's so quiet, and you're just like cruising, you know, under sail. And you know, I got to have some fun. I just got to climb the mast and do some stuff up there, and you know, but there was a lot of engineering work. That boat was old, and it was falling apart, and you're busy, so you know.
that's just typical Coast Guard.
Well, right, yeah. Every boat apart, right? Coast Guard, yeah.
Did you have to climb the mast and stuff? I mean,
I didn't have to, but we always had, when we had sail stations, each of the crew members would be assigned specific masts to help oversee site safety and, you know, watch the cadets as they're doing their thing. So we got to do it. Yeah.
Very cool.
Tina, I have a question about Eagle, and without like going, you know, down the wrong path or saying anything that would embarrass the guilty parties. I've generally heard that that's where, like, the JOs or the future JOs, you know, they're cooped up in the academy all the time and they get on there and some of them just absolutely lose their minds. Did you experience that at all?
Like,
did you see that from them?
Probably not when I was on there as a fireman so much, but as an MK1 when I went back, some of the port calls, you know, they kind of go a little crazy. So, like, all of us, you know, are free.
Right.
Beers flowing and, you know.
That's good, though. At least they kept it contained, you know? Like, you didn't even figure out about it until you were in E6, so that's a good thing.
That was a good command, then.
Yeah. Right? Who was your CO when you were on there, Tina?
So I had Captain Gross in 94, and then I believe then Captain Stillman took over, and then... So when I was leaving, it was, you know, Admiral Stillman, then Captain Stillman. And then trying to think when I went back, Admiral Papp was he just leaving or just getting there when I left? He was on one end of the other. Drawing a blank on his name. He actually just passed away. He had a brain cancer, brain tumor or something. Yeah. So it'll come to me, but.
But memory. I mean, like heavyweights of the service, a future commandant.
Yeah.
I mean, flags. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, Captain Pulver was the CO on there as well. So
you
now
knew who I was going to ask about. That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You knew where that
so
was going.
So I do work at the National Coast Guard Museum too. So
right.
Yeah.
Very cool. Good. Well, when you went back as an MK1, why did you decide to go back?
So that's the funny story. So all throughout my career, like I begged to get underway. Like when the new 87s were coming out, I was putting in for everyone that would be rolling off the blocks. Like, just get me underway. I wanted to serve afloat. I wanted to do my whole tour, or my whole career afloat. That's what I wanted to do. But every time I would ask, they'd be like, oh, well, we don't have berthing, or, oh, you don't meet the priority, or this, that, and the other. So it was just a constant battle trying to get underway afloat time. When I was at the strike team, as an MK1, we were priority 5. I put in my dream sheet, you know, same deal, any cutter, whatever, just listed them all. And, you know, wanted to get underway. And, you know, they came back and said, well, we don't have anything for you that's on your list. And we've all dealt with the detailers. So, you know, they do their thing and we do, you know, okay, well, send me here.
Throwing darts. I swear to God, I think it's a dartboard somewhere.
Yeah. And then, so they're like, well, we don't have anything on your list. You know, you don't, your priority's not high enough to get to these, you know, highly demanding cutters, like, or highly, you know, desired cutters, the 225s, the 175s, all these cutters that I wanted to go to kind of like round out my engineering career. So I was, they're like, well, Eagle's open. And I was like, well, I'll go back to Eagle, you know, they have everything. I know the job. I know what they do. I'll go back to Eagle. So I was like, you know, okay, we'll do that. And, you know, I ended up going back to Eagle and it challenged me in a lot of ways and it was great. And I enjoyed it. We had some great port calls. I had some really awesome mentors on board and great people again. And, you know, just back again and, you know, doing the same thing. So
you say it challenged you in a lot of ways. Can you speak to, like, you know, like the most impactful maybe?
Well, I think, you know, I was the MK1 going into main prop. I had a chief and a warrant above me, a phenomenal warrant officer. We had a couple chiefs changing out. So I was pretty much in charge of main prop at the time. You know, and which is kind of a big deal, you know, granted it was pretty small, but it was a big deal for me. So, you know, I took a lot of pride in that and the leadership challenges, you know, cause you're working with cadets and you're trying to like teach and mentor and hone them. So you have that all summer long and then you have your own like shop, your own crew trying to keep motivated and, you know, get them, you know, on board with things. And we had, you know, just the equipment, you know, I then moved over to A-Gang, took over A-Gang when the other MK1 left. And then we had all that equipment. So you're all over the place, you know, all over the ship. So
you never got a rest, right? Like between main prop, because I remember being on ships and like every patrol was different. It was either main prop had a miserable patrol or A-Gang had a miserable patrol. And it seemed like it went back and forth.
Yeah.
Since you did them both, like you got everything.
I mean, I'd say main prop for sure was a lot easier, you know,
yeah.
Oh, we're sailing. Okay. So now we can, you know, go take a walk up on deck when you're the EOW or do whatever, you know, but A-Gang, it's all the creature comforts. Everybody's complaining about the air conditioning, the refrigerator, the reefers aren't working, you know, the RO, we're not making enough water. It's just like all the time. So it was challenging in those ways, which was just good. So.
When that's Tina, you're one of the few MKs that we've had on so far. Could you, like, for anybody, because I'm sure a lot of people that are listening don't know what main prop A-Gang is. Can you just like?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So main prop is that's your main engine room. You know, that's where your main engine systems are. And so usually the departments, the divisions are split into main prop or A-Gang, which is the auxiliary equipment. Auxiliary equipment basically was everything outside of the engine room. Mm-hmm. Main prop was engine room, shaft, boilers sometimes, you know, at least on Eagle. But so it's usually split in those two divisions for at least the MK side of things.
Perfect. I would have had no idea how to explain that. So thanks for explaining it to me too.
Yeah.
Boat guy.
yeah. Your water, your air conditioning, all the things that, you know, the comforts of life, that's A-Gang. So you learn to love your A-Gang people.
Except for the toilets, right? The toilets is the DCs.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It depends. Usually
it's like,
Yeah. So the GCs had like the actual toilets. We had the actual like containment systems. So when, you know, the tanks were clogged or whatever, that was ours. And then they,
I heard a story one time of like a relief valve on Eagle. Like,
oh my God.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I've heard that. What happened with that? What was that whole thing?
So this actually happened. It's happened quite a number of times.
That's
so
funny, dude. Of course it did, right? Because we can't fix it. We just got to keep, like, responding.
Yeah, so the main ventilation shaft for the toilets, the sewage tank, went up the main mast and kind of was like, you know, it's like the vent. So the vent goes up the main mast. And when I was at MK1, I think, we had a guy standing in EOW, and we came back to the ship after we were on port call or whatever. We came back to the ship, and he was, usually we would flush out the systems. Like if we were emptying the sewage tank, we were tied up to the shore ties and emptying out the sewage tank. We'd then turn on the fire main system to flush everything out. Well, if you didn't have those valves lined up right, you were basically pushing fire main water into the sewage tank. And if you weren't paying attention and, you know, alarms weren't going off or anything else, you're filling up basically.
Let's see where this is going.
And then, you know, the relief is your vent that goes up the mast. And so what do we say? The schitzel, or because it was the stasels or something like that. Yeah. So dumping sewage, gallons of raw sewage, mostly pumped out, but sewage all over the main deck is not a fun thing to do.
And on people sometimes, right? Like, the story I heard was like a young cadet standing under this thing and then it starts raining poo from the sky.
That happens. And then, so like, you know, you only usually pump at night when nobody's like touring the boat.
Smart.
Yeah, so that happens. Yeah, maybe they've got it fixed by now. I don't know.
Probably not.
Is it a confusing system, Tina? Like, is it easy to line the valves up wrong? Even a dumb person like me, I've pumped sewage before.
Yeah, but if you're not paying attention, you know, and you really just need to crack that that valve to flush out the lines and then close it again. But if you're not paying attention, or if you're new and, you know, you just got qualified, which I think is what happened in this case. So the guy, like, he was pretty new and got qualified. And, you know, usually we try to have a couple people around when it's happening, but everything else was out drinking. So
What was your import duty section like on there? Like, how many people to stand watch import?
Permanent crew, we didn't have very many. The cadets would get qualified and stand like quarter deck watch, and they'd give the tours, you know, because we roped off the main decks to give tours every time we pull into port. So they did a lot of that. They did a lot of the mess cooking. You know, they augmented our crew significantly.
Sounds like a great job as John right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, I'm not going to lie. It wasn't bad duty. Calls, like, you know, cause the secondary mission is public affairs. So you're going to all the best port calls. So,
right.
Well, what about the strike team?
So strike team, I went to the strike team when I left Barnegat Light. I was kind of wavering. Am I staying? Am I going? Am I, you know, staying in? Am I getting out? Went through the whole process again with the dream sheets and can't get underway. Can't go to 225. Can't do this. Was going to go to a Loran station. Asked the detailer, hey, I want to go to a Loran station, get my priority up so then I can go to a 225 or something. The Loran station that was open, I think it was like Port Clarence or something. They're like, yeah, we're not really sending women there anymore. So
where's Port Clarence at?
Huh?
Where was it at? Where's Port Clarence?
Like one of the islands of Alaska. Like,
oh yeah. Good times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So fortunately, I didn't go there, but, and I was like, well, you know, what's this strike team of all about? And I saw the Coast Guard bulletin had the guy scrubbing ducks full of oil. So I was like, that looks kind of cool. So, and then I was like, if I go there, you know, I can get some different specialized training. If I do decide to get out, I can use that. And so that was the interview process. I had an interview with them and, you know, they had to tell the detailers yay or nay. So I got orders to strike team. That was in 99. Got there, was completely clueless for about a year. It was a whole new side of the Coast Guard that I just had no idea about. It's almost like it's a separate entity, but I learned a lot there. And then, so I was there 4 years, and we were there during 9/11 for the response for 9/11 down at the World Trade Center. So my whole team was there for a long time after 9/11 doing cleanup, site safety. Came down here to DC when anthrax was going on here. So we were busy and constantly on the go. Like, you're living out of a bag. Like, you know, you get home, you put your stuff away, and your phone rings, and you're like, you're on the road again. So for 3 weeks or whatever. But,
and what was the, so what's the, I guess two questions, what's the mission of the strike team? And then what was your like specific role there?
So, you know, they do pollution, chemical and hazardous material response. So under, like, a lot of times the EPA, so the EPA can call up the strike team and say, we have this Superfund site and we need team members to come and do site safety or air monitoring or any of the specialized functions that we did. I went there, I was at MK2, so I was in the engineering department division. Was trained on, you know, first response as far as the level A, B, C, and, you know, D response. We had response.
Can you put on the cool suit?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, awesome. Level A.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was like three levels of response. You had a response member, response technician, or response supervisor. And I think I was a supervisor when I left that last year. But different levels of like what you did on different sites. So a lot of my first job was a tire fire in Sycamore, Ohio. So that was like the very first job response I went on.
Are you like, what am I doing here? What?
Yeah, I know. You're like, okay, so, you know, I'm asking myself, like, what? I didn't even know this was like the Coast Guard did this. So, and of course, everybody there is like, Coast Guard, what are you doing here? So,
how does that play out? Well, now we got to talk about it. We got to talk about the tire fire in Ohio.
So many ridiculous jokes pop up in my mind for the tire fire in Ohio.
Because the tires, when they're on fire, they leach off like oil and they go into like the tributaries and the streams and they get in the waterways. So we had to set up these like underflow dams to get the oil kind of, you know, blocked off and barricaded off. So, yeah.
Very cool. Who would have thought? Yeah. Like, was it on the Ohio River or what?
So eventually gone into the Ohio River. Yeah. So we weren't actually on the river. It was actually in the middle of, like, nowhere. But, you know, eventually the oil kind of makes its way there.
Tina, that's crazy. You went from a tire fire in Ohio to 9/11 to an anthrax scare in the nation's capital. Like,
yeah, I know. Just like
U.S. Coast Guard, man.
My first career, you know, go to the strike team.
Crazy.
That's a Coast Guard commercial right there.
It
tire
is,
fires,
for sure.
Anthrax.
Yeah, no, it was cool. I learned a ton, and, you know, just most of, like, you know, kind of what we were in charge of. We had hydraulic pumps and we had oil skimmers and we had kind of, you know, all the chemical gear. We were just getting into like chemical and biological response. I went through schools that taught you how to respond to tank cars and rail cars and any type of hazmat. You know, we went through Army radiation training because we were right there on Fort Dix. We had a lot of training with the guys there. So just anything and everything.
So I'm thinking, Tina, like, you know, they hand out those CBR kits to boat crews. You know what I'm talking about, right? With the mask and the Tyvek suit and stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you kind of take it seriously, right? If we ever got to put this on, it's good to know. But you're like, when you dress out in level A gear, I'm assuming just seeing that stuff would be a whole nother level of, man, this is real. This is legit.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah. Like, even if the SCBA dies, I'm probably not getting oxygen because I'm assuming, you know, the suit's sealed, right?
Yeah, you're in the suit, right?
Yeah, so, like, how serious does that get? I mean, as a supervisor, I'm guessing, you know, are you in charge of making sure everybody's doing the right thing when they're putting that stuff on?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, response supervisors, they did, you know, some of the smaller jobs, but you always had, like, because we had a whole officer corps, like, you know, industrial hygienists and things like that. So there was always, like, the backup of the backup of the backup to make sure, you know, safety is of, you know, the utmost, you know, concern with everybody. So there was one, it was in Baltimore. We had a train on fire in the tunnel. And this would have been, I don't know, maybe 2000. So our team, you know, we drove down there, we were all night, we got there, we got set up, and we were going to go in the tunnel with some of the other environmental protection agencies, the local ones, the local guys, but we didn't have our SCBA containers weren't compatible. They were, one was MSA, one was Scott, one or the other. So they weren't compatible with the connections to each other. So we made the decision to say, you know, we're not going in outside of anybody with our team. We'll go in with our team, but we're not going to mix team members like one-on-one. Because if you run out of air, you got to change packs, you know, and all they had was the different packs. So we made the decision not to go in, and come to find out those guys got pulled out because they ran out of air and didn't have a backup SCBAs to swap out. They ended up getting pulled out, smoke inhalation and everything. So yeah,
it's all I could think was like Apollo 13, like you're in this tunnel and it's like, how do I make the square fit into the, crazy.
Get the duct tape out.
Right.
And, yeah.
Just make something happen. Wild. So yeah. If you guys would have went, or when you went in the tunnel, what's kind of your role when you get down in there? Like, what are you actually doing at a train fire in a tunnel?
Well, a lot of it is, you know, you have to do like an assessment of what's going on so you can do the proper response to it. So, right. So as long as like safety of life is paramount, you check and make sure, you know, the stuff that was on fire, you know, there was a rail car on fire and then there was other rail cars that had different chemicals in them. So you have to know what you're going into, checking manifests and knowing that, okay, if this catches on fire, this dangerous chemical is going to be really bad. So you're basically doing an initial assessment, doing some air monitoring and checks like that. You're the eyes for the responders that are like on the back end, kind of planning everything out. So you're reporting back what you're seeing and things like that. So,
dude, where's that recruiting photo, you know, of like, of you in the level A suit, the train on fire, I'm in a tunnel that's submerged, like, right. Yeah. Wild. What a cool mission. Seriously, what a cool mission.
Yeah, anthrax was interesting because when we responded to that here in D.C., like, I think a couple of our guys were in a room where they forgot to shut the ventilation off and they weren't in SCBAs yet. So there was a potential that they were exposed to anthrax and, like, the whole, like, response personnel that was responding to this, you know, the Senate Heart Building, going in these different buildings and checking for anthrax or, you know, balines or whatever, we're all on, like, high-grade antibiotics, doxycycline, cipro. They're just, like, giving it to us like candy, like, here, take this, it'll protect you. And it's like, okay.
Crazy. Yeah, I can, you know, like even the anthrax vaccine, when you get the shot, it's, I always tell people it's like the most painful shot I've ever got. I don't, it's like number 3 and number 8 or something.
Yeah.
But those, it feels like your arm's falling off.
I was fortunate enough to avoid that. They were having some supply issues when we were supposed to get it.
Yeah, score for you.
I managed to avoid that one too.
They're terrible.
Who knows what I would have by then.
So in the anthrax thing, same thing, like air monitoring and just trying to make sure the space is cleared.
Yeah,
like, did you get to see the white powder, you know, like, did you guys,
we didn't come across really anything. A lot of it was senators asking us to do things like pick up these important documents or, you know, feed their fish or water their plants.
You're like rolling up into John Boehner's office. Like, hey, I'm going to feed your fish for you, sir. That's good. That's awesome.
That's awesome.
What a crazy mission.
That's why it's not on a recruiting poster, Phil.
Yeah, I guess so, huh?
Right.
Dude, I love this podcast, man. You never know, like, you just never know. You never know what you're going to hear.
It's amazing what you find out, right?
It really is. Well, Tino, what about the, let's talk about your underway tour on the midget. So you finally got there.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
I did, yeah.
As a chief.
I was like, yeah, this would have been nice when I was in MK2, thanks. Now I'm in charge of A-Gang. Not a clue about a 378. So.
Where are the sales? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a lot of A-Gang there too, huh?
Oh my God, yeah. It was good though. I enjoyed being underway again. I enjoyed doing that side of the missions again. And again, challenged just running a shop that's like all this equipment everywhere, trying to keep things like maintained and running. And it was a lot, but had great crew and, you know, just, we did some cool stuff. You know, we got some drug runners, you know, there's nothing better than being on a 378 and listening to the turbines light off and then just go in, you know, that's pretty cool. So
that's cool that even the engineer says that. Cause I would think you're like, oh my God, don't break it. You know, or just something. That's awesome.
She was A-Gang. They weren't her problem.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the auxiliary stuff. Yeah. Just don't clog the toilets. We'll be okay.
Right. Yeah.
That's DC-1's problem.
Yeah. Depending, unless it's the tank. No, I learned right. that today. Yeah.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah. No, I had my fireman was cleaning out the toilet or the sewage vacuum tank one time, and he got sprayed full of crap.
Oh.
Poor guy. He had, like, you know.
Dude, we're all so juvenile. We're just laughing at, like, poo stories.
I know. About it,
you can't help it, though. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So,
I think every cutter has that underway story. Like, every tour on every cutter, somebody gets sprayed with doo-doo.
Yeah.
So we got a guest on. We have a somebody watching us live. Matty Wood. Bill and I both know him. I know, crazy. Matt, good to see you.
Stories.
He had a question for you though, Tina. He asks, and I'm gonna reframe it. When you were talking about the Eagle, he asked what was the best port call and the worst port call. I would ask you, what's the best port call on the Eagle compared to the port call on the Midget?
So I would say, let's see, best port call on Eagle was for sure Madeira, Portugal. That was actually my last port call before I transferred off of there. Beautiful place. It was amazing. And it might have been the best one just because I was leaving and, you know.
Everything stops being your problem.
But we did a whole Europe tour when I was at MK1 there. So we went all over Ireland, Germany, France, Scotland. I mean, like the dream places that I missed out when I was a fireman, but I got on the other end. So... and of course, like Midget, I think our only port call was like Golfito. <You know?
laughs> That's a good port call.
Yeah.
Golfito's a good port call.
We never went north, so we always went south. So, yeah.
That's funny. What about, did you cross any lines or anything? Like, what was the...
We did do a line crossing, yes. Yeah. Yep. So that was fun.
And then, did you go through Chief's initiation on board the cutter?
I actually went through initiation when I was at Sector Long Island Sound.
Okay.
So, all right. Yeah.
So that doesn't count. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Did you say, Phil, did you go through Chief's initiation on the cutter?
No, I went through it at Yorktown. I know. It's pretty bad, too. But at least
so
we're...
Did I.
Yeah, I know. We can't say much.
Well, I think it was indoctrination when I went through, so it wasn't, you know...
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's all right, too.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Those are lost for words.
Yeah, I know, man. Yeah. Well, when you made Chief, Tina, so, you know, like we said, it's the centennial year of the Chiefs, right? What did it mean to you? And then what's it still mean to you, I guess?
You know, I was actually listening to John Ostrowski's
Who's also podcast. Watching right now.
Oh, hey, John. and, you know, what does it mean? You know, I think he said something like, you know, we all grow up in the Coast Guard as knowing like this chief stature, right? And either, you know, it's like, oh, here's the chief or whatever. But on Eagle, like we had the chief's mess and, you know, initially they were all really scary and intimidating. But ultimately, like they just care about the crew and like they care about taking care of the crew and making sure that the decisions are made are in the best interest of everybody. So, you know, I always look to that as like, you know, I without a doubt came into the Coast Guard and was like, I want to be a chief someday. Like I want to be a salty old master chief with a cigar hanging out of my mouth. Don't ask me why, but
because it's cool. That's why.
Yeah. So I just had, you know, I had great chief mentors. I had a few not great, but you know, you learn from both sides, and you try to establish your leadership and your mentorship based on, you know, how you want to be treated. And I just really hoped that I had been a chief for the younger guys to look up to and girls to look up to, and you know, and recall that that's how like my chief treated me. So I'm going to, you know, carry that on to how I'm going to treat other people. So, I just think it's just a position that's unlike any other. Like you have this technical ability side that you've learned and grew up, you know, learning through the Coast Guard. And then you have this kind of leadership mentorship that, you know, ultimately I never felt ready, but I think as a chief and you grew and you learn to lean on other chiefs, I think you grow, you continue to grow as a chief. You kind of have to fake it till you make it, kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't know if I ever really felt ready, but I did what the best I could. So
that's a cool way to put it. I think you kind of fake it till you make it. Cause you're like, no matter what, it's just one of those trains that keeps running.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're ready or not. Like they're going to come and be like, "Hey chief, I need this," or you know, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think every position I had ever been in, I'm like, didn't feel like I was ready, but you step into it and you just do it. You dive right in. And
it's so weird. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. No. It's so weird. Like when you make chief, everybody talks about it, but until you experience it, you know, you go from being that BM1, MK1, whatever, one day, and a bunch of people didn't care at all what your opinion was.
Yeah.
The next day, you're the exact same person, and suddenly they're super interested in what you have to say. And it's almost surreal when it first happens.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole time coming up as a junior petty officer, I was like, oh, when I make chief, they're going to listen to me, you know.
Denied.
They're gonna listen to me.
Just going to complain to you. No,
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah.
I always thought, you know, the coolest, or maybe not the coolest moment, but the most like eye-opening was when you finally have that problem that they brought you that requires you to talk to officers. You know, and you're like, man, how much weight does this anchor really carry, right? And then you walk in there. Yeah, so I thought that was a cool moment, one that I look back to. Hey, John asked us a question, or asked you a question. Which female chief in your Coast Guard history scared you the most?
Scared me the most.
Right, so scared you the most.
Well, you know, you don't run across a lot of female chiefs in the Coast Guard, at least not when I was coming through, but there was a female chief at Yorktown. She was an MK, Chief Thomas, I believe her name was, and she yelled at me for, I think I had the wrong hair thing in my hair or something. She scared the crap out of me because I was like, here's this female chief, and I'm like looking up to her, and then I'm just getting like yelled at by her, but...
Like, I'm going to send you home.
Yeah.
Right.
But God, I think she was the only female chief.
I'm going to ask him who scared him the most.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was his?
Well, let's go. So, I mean, you're talking about how chiefs impact the, you know, look out for the best interests of the crew. That's kind of their primary role, right? To make sure those decisions line up with expectations and their needs. So you go to headquarters and you fill two pretty vital roles up there that were, you know, one for both, I guess, kind of like for new initiatives, Women Afloat and for sexual assault prevention and response. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how, you know, I mean, what was your time like in the Puzzle Palace working on such a new initiative and then being a female doing it?
Well, so the Women Afloat coordinator role was really like, having struggled to get afloat through my whole career, that was kind of like the pinnacle. Like, I want to go to this job and I want to see what it's all about and I want to try to change it because I didn't feel there was enough communication involved with it. I didn't feel like there was enough, you know, how does this work, you know, behind the closed doors? How does this really work? And how are we impacting for people's careers? Because I kind of felt that my career was impacted in that, like, I could never get like an EPO job because, you know, I hadn't had the small boat afloat experience. And I was like, I didn't have any available. So how am I supposed to get that experience and then become an EPO? And so I felt there was a lot of things that I just felt that I could change or help communicate more about. And, you know, most people that went into that role, they weren't necessarily operational, you know, Cutterman going into that job. The girl that I relieved, she was, and they had just really started pushing more openness with regards to women afloat at that time. So I was really in a good position to take that over and see if I could make any, you know, improvements or changes into the program. And, you know, even as I was a third or a young petty officer, and I would ask, well, what is this? Because the Women Afloat Coordinator had been around since the 90s. I think Diane Bucci actually had it, or she was in, you know, in headquarters when that role stood up. So it just, nobody really knew anything about it. So even when I would ask they do the detail of road shows, I'm like, well, what does this person do? And they're like, well, I don't know. You know,
here's her number though. Yeah. Feel free to call her.
Crack racks on cutters. Okay. Well,
that's a detailer's number one job, is to not answer your question.
Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of like, if I'm going to like leave the Coast Guard, that's the job I want to leave in. So I took the job. I was fortunate enough. It was open. I short toured off a midget, which, you know, was able to take that job and move into it. And, you know, I kind of went in really high charged and excited. Like, they want me here. They want me to change things. And then headquarters was tough for me. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, it was hard in the fact that, like, I just didn't fit in very good. So you're a chief, but yet, like, headquarters is so top heavy. Mm-hmm. You're really just, you're a chief, but you're really not, you don't have that kind of authority like a chief does at a small boat station or a smaller unit.
Right.
So it was a tough position for me to go in, but I absolutely loved it because I felt that when women, you know, pushed out communications and women were actually calling me and asking me about afloat opportunities, they were asking me about, you know, I really hoped that I could inspire other women to get underway and take those chances and take those tough jobs and do whatever I could possibly do to make sure that they could get into a cutter by rack availability and assignment availability and work with the detailers in that regard. And for the most part, the detailers were really open to what I was trying to do. Some weren't, you know, I was not a detailer, so I was a coordinator. So I didn't have any authority to detail women to ships. I had to work with that detailer. And if they didn't feel that was the right position for me, even though I had that rack open, and in order to maintain that cutter as a mixed gender cutter, I had to fill that rack with a woman. You know, they had other things that they were worried about as well. So priority and things like that. So it was a tough job, but I loved it. I loved working with women and hopefully mentoring them into getting underway and afloat.
So. Yeah. And you see, I mean, you know, like, I'd say they definitely picked the right person for the job because, I mean, you've talked about twice, you know, at least that your assignments were impacted because of opportunities. Hopefully it's gotten better. And I'm sure you set a solid example to go.
I think people going into that job now, I think they go into it because they want to, instead of just, right. Oh, there's, you know, this person's a colo and we're going to throw them there and they can just track racks on spreadsheets. So
were you at the old headquarters or the new one?
I started at the old one in Ballston, and then we moved. Oh, I got pulled into a different work group thing. We moved into the old headquarters. Yeah, there was like three headquarters. So Ballston was where EPM was, and then the old headquarters where everybody else was. And
were
then
you in the mall? Was that the mall where the, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was in the mall, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, the first time, remember the deployable operations group? I remember I got called. I don't know why, but I had to go up to the office, and I'm like, I drive there and I'm like, dude, this is at a mall. Like, what are we doing? Yeah. And then made a phone call and they're like, yeah, just walk up, like take the escalator to the second floor and third door on your right. Crazy. That's wild.
It's right behind the Baskin Robbins.
Yeah. Go get my Starbucks every day.
Unreal. Well, so then you got into the SAPR program. How did that kind of thing happen? Did you volunteer for it? Voluntold?
So when I was the Women Afloat Coordinator, I got pulled into this work group called the Outlook Vision Team, which was a separate work group altogether. And then the SAPR programs stood up, the Military Campaign Office stood up, and I had volunteered to be kind of like somebody they could reach into if they needed. And I don't think I knew that it was actually a permanent job, but then I went over there and kind of like, oh, by the way, this is a one-year tour, and we don't have a backfill for your Women Afloat Coordinator job until next summer. So I was actually doing two jobs at the same time. which was fine because you had the season, you know, where you're doing assignments and things like that, and it was kind of off season, so we were standing up this major campaign for sexual assault and prevention and response for the Coast Guard, and it was a handpicked team of, there was five of us, so it was fast paced, and you know, we were just hit the ground running trying to get this you know, this issue, like, you know, you can't fix it, but you know, you have to address it and you have to communicate and train and make people aware and things like that. So it was supposed to be a 1 year office that stood up, and then it turned into 2 years, and then I think it turned into 3 years, and then it kind of like dissolved and absorbed back into the programs that were responsible for the program, and I think it's been kind of disbanded by now, but they're still running the program.
How do you feel about your work in that role particularly? Like, do you feel like you, I mean, did you leave with a sense of accomplishment?
No,
you know. Yeah, I was just going to speak to it, like, as far as, you know, when I came in, it was something that you never heard about. And I mean, I don't know, like you said, I don't know how much you can, how much has actually changed, but I will say, like, I think everyone now knows about that program, knows all the resources available, knows not to be a bystander. And, you know, I think everybody's got the slogan, not in my Coast Guard. So you should feel accomplished, I guess, is kind of my point.
Yeah, and it's being at headquarters where you had varying viewpoints and different ways to go about things. And so I felt kind of defeated only because, like, I didn't feel like we fixed it when we disbanded. But we did gain a lot of awareness. We did a lot of training. We did a lot of great things. I took it to heart a lot more, I think, because when I was in the Women Afloat coordinator job, you know, I'm trying to inspire women to go afloat. And then I go into this other job, and then I'm seeing these same women, some of them coming off of cutters because of the situation, you know, that happened. And that was like, it was tough on me. You know, I think it was tough on me emotionally. And I think I left the service kind of with that emotional kind of like baggage, you know? So, yeah.
I got you. I mean, that's all I would say is, like, just to maybe put one in the plus column is that I definitely think that you guys made a huge change in awareness, made a huge change in just knowledge and resources and all that's probably.
I agree with Phil. It's in my time in it has changed a ton in terms of even willingness to even acknowledge that it happens.
Right. I see it. And I think it's amazing that people are having conversations about it instead of, like, not thinking or talking about it. We're having a conversation about it, which is huge, you know? Right. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, let's take it back. Let's take it to something back to our roots. What takes seas better, the Coast Guard Cutter Eagle or the Coast Guard Cutter Melon?
What does what?
What takes seas better?
What
rides better? The Midget or the Eagle?
If you can get used to walking on like a 45 degree angle, the Eagle takes the seas much better.
Nice. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Wow. Who's got to put all the stuff away? Like, when it happened, is it just all hands on deck effort, like secure for sea?
Yeah.
Did the officers eat at a 45 degree angle?
Oh, we had, when I was at MK1 on board, we hit a really bad storm, and I was just going below decks, and all you could hear was like bodies flailing all over the deck. And I think some cadets they got really hurt. Oh.
I know Bill and I were like laughing, and then it's like, oh wait, somebody actually got hurt.
But no, it's like, cause you can get into those seas. The Eagle is just, you know, they're either like back and forth or it just, I mean, it gets pretty rough. So yeah, we actually injured some cadets. So
I just saw that face again. We're sailing, and then it's over.
Yeah.
Well, Tina, let's talk.
Bill Murray tied to the mast on, and what about Bob?
I can't, you know, there's got to be some like crazy nautical age of sail stuff that happens on that boat too. Just people tied to the mast, lashed different places.
You know what you should have on is Carl Dillman.
Okay.
Do you know him?
No, you have to point us to him later.
I'll have to connect you to him. He basically lives, breathes, talked Eagle. Like, he's the guy to have on with Eagle stories.
Cool.
For sure. Yeah. Wes could probably hook you up with him. I think he's got his contact info.
Well, Tina, I'm going to ask you now. Let's talk about Halcyon Reflections, and let's talk about that Chief Centennial logbook that you're making.
Okay.
Tell us what it is.
So the Chief Centennial logbook, so with my company, I do, I help people preserve stories in, generally my offerings are in like personal, like collective, like memory books, right? So you take all your stuff and then you curate it down and then you kind of put it in chronological order of your career, not just Coast Guard, but could be family history, could be career history, organizational history, whatever. So with the Chief's logbook, I love bringing in historical pieces as well as like personal history. So I really wanted to provide some historical snippets regarding the Chiefs and kind of like, you know, where that role has evolved over the years, but also provide a place where individuals could either reflect on their own history, either as a chief or a chief that they knew, or maybe a family member that was a chief. To write down those things and those little snippets within their career to kind of reflect on. And ultimately, you know, I do these things to provide for family members generations down the road. So, you know, they open up their closet, here's all the stuff, and here's this book that describes this patch, this certificate, this award, and that kind of thing.
That's right. It's very cool. We're gonna buy two of them when we get off here, by the way. Okay. And you're gonna tell us like where, because I haven't bought mine yet. So I'm gonna buy one. Yeah. The podcast is gonna buy mine, and it's gonna buy Bill's. So there we go. There's two.
I'm all for it.
Yeah.
I'm actually gonna be given a. So I find a lot of people don't like to like write. They like to type.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna give a PDF like electronic version if you want to type in your own stuff too. So
cool.
Yeah,
I definitely won't be writing by hand.
It's some people write, you know, like our older generation, they're really not on the computers. So I wanted to provide things that they could like, just even just dates, you got to provide clues for your family. I mean, if you've ever done any type of research, whether it's your family history or career history or anything, that little clue that, you know, is gold for them.
Yeah, I think what you're doing, that sounds like a really awesome thing. A friend of my wife's was just going through like some of her grandparents' stuff, mm-hmm. and texted us a bunch of pictures of all these like patches her grandpa had, yeah. from like World War II. And she's like, you know anything about these? I mean, just because, yeah. I'm in the military doesn't mean, mm-hmm. I know what that patch means. But
yeah.
So this is a really cool thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I work with a lot of older people and, you know, they're always like, well, I don't know what to do with all this stuff. I knew it meant something to them or their spouse or their, you know, grandfather or whatever, but I don't know what to do with it. So I really want to be able to give them this like nice book that they can like leave on their coffee table and look through and reflect on, you know, grandpa's history or grandma's history or whatever.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And to be able, I mean, I imagine it being that kind of thing you find in the attic 50 years from now and you're like, oh my God, grandpa or great grandpa did what?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think that's the best sales pitch.
Survive on your phone.
Yeah, that was the best sales pitch you could have given. Like, so if you're looking at that big shoebox full of photos in your closet, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh my God, we now found the person for you to call. Yeah,
yeah,
very cool.
Yeah.
100%.
What's the craziest thing that somebody submitted for the Chief's logbook?
Yeah, I haven't gotten a lot of, I'm a little disappointed because I was hoping this could be kind of a collaborative, like, tell me your sea stories, send me pictures of your hat box kind of thing. And I'm not great at the whole social media advertising, so I didn't get a lot of stuff. But so if anybody's got any cool stuff they want to see in the book, you know, I'm still taking it. You know, I'll take a look and see what you got.
Oh,
but,
dude, I hope you just opened it up right there. That would be awesome. Yeah, I'm getting pretty good at social media. I'm going to hit it out all over the place.
The information's all on the halcyonreflections.com, Chief 100. Yeah, I would love to see different stories come out of it, you know, because – you know, like there's not a ton of stuff out there about our chief's history. And I don't want to put a whole bunch of, oh, this first person and a whole bunch of stuff that it's already out there. You know, it's nothing new or exciting, but there'll be some cool stuff in there. But I really want this to be somebody owns it and creates their history out of it, too. So
very cool. I thought you were going to say that you got a whole bunch of pictures of guys with cigars in their mouth looking angry. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Well, so where can they find Halcyon Reflections?
So I have a website, Halcyon, and it's Halcyon. So I don't know if you guys know what Halcyon is, but
I have no idea. I couldn't even say it when we started. Remember?
I could say it, but I don't know what it means.
Well, so, I could guess, but it, yeah.
there was a term that was like the Halcyon days, the good old days of yesterday. Right. You know, I think it was back in the '70s or something. But there's also a little bit of a nautical tie into it. In Greek mythology, it's actually like a kingfisher that used to nest on the waves and calm the ocean. So you can Google it. You can find out, you know, on Webster's or whatever, but that's
cool. Cool. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I love it. What a great name choice.
So there you go. Everybody out there listening, if you've got a cool chief story, whether it's yours or something you witnessed, get in contact. Let's make this book amazing.
Yeah.
And if you got that shoebox full.
Delivery date about a month out, because I thought it would be interesting to kind of correlate everything that's going on with COVID-19 2020, you know, where we were in 1920. So I pushed the delivery out a little bit. So I'm still taking pre-orders. I'll take them all the way up until the end of the month, probably. So
hashtag not my apocalypse is what you're going to get from me.
2020 is canceled.
Yeah.
Start over next year.
Yeah, I feel like we should do it. Yeah.
2020 was a bad idea this time.
Yeah.
Hey man, we're still having a great time though. And Tina, like positive stories like yours are helping people get through it. So thanks for sharing it today. We really appreciate your time. We appreciate your service. Absolutely. And we thank you for serving the country. And thanks for what you're doing to keep the heritage of Chief Petty Officers alive.
Yeah. And thank you guys for doing what you do. I think we all share the same mission as preserving our stories. It's our history. So
100%. Sure.
Yeah. Thanks for your time today, Tina. And thanks for some really good stories.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Stay safe and stay healthy.
Yeah. You too.
All right. Thanks.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.